After a decade abroad, the National Book Award and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Evan Osnos returns to three places that he has lived in the United States of America: Greenwich, Connecticut, Clarksburg, West Virginia, and Chicago, Illinois, to illuminate the origins of America's political fury. The name of the book is Wildland: The Making of America's Fury. It is published by FSG. Evan is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a CNN contributor, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. Glad to be with you.
How did this project come to be?
Yeah, I think it was something that a lot of us are aware of. We talk about it. It's just a fact of our time that we feel so fractured and divided, but it was particularly vivid and kind of shocking to me, having been away. I mean, when you go away and you come home, there is that strange moment of awareness where you sort of, you look at the house you love and you say, well, it looks like we kind of need to fix the roof tiles over here, and this place has gotten a little overgrown and so on. And that's really how I felt about American politics when I came back from being overseas, was that it was so clear that we had kind of jumped the guardrails of what had been, you know, always periods of turmoil and divisiveness in American history, but we'd entered into a particularly acute phase, and I just was desperate to describe and understand for my own benefit how we got here. What were the key moments along the way?
Why were you gone? How long were you gone?
I went overseas for a decade as a reporter. I was a reporter I lived in New York at 9/11 and kind of covered the aftermath of the attacks. And then that led me eventually to being a reporter in Iraq. I worked for the Chicago Tribune and elsewhere in the Middle East and so on. And eventually in China. And when we came back, my wife, Sarah Beth, and I, we realized, you know, it was time to come home. We're Americans and wanted to kind of reconnect with our own place again. And I said, if I want to understand what's changed in the years I was gone, I got to go back to places I know, places I love, places I've lived, you know, because that's the only way I can really capture what's changed over time rather than dropping in for the first time.
You pinpointed to August 6, 2015, was you knew you had to write the book. This was the first night of the Republican presidential debate. Why that night?
Well, I was with some Trump supporters at a guy's house in Ohio, and there was a group of people who were watching the debate, and you know, this was kind of Trump's first moment on the full national broadcast, you know, center stage. He'd been bubbling up over the course of a few weeks on the campaign trail, but everybody assumed it was kind of a short-lived thing. And that night, I remember that the host of that watch party was drinking out of a coffee cup with a swastika on it. And what struck me about it was, you know, he's a guy who identifies as a white nationalist, kind of sees himself that way. And what struck me was, all right, it's not that surprising. I guess I've always, you know, we all know there are people out there who would still, you know, find their sort of neo-Nazi types. But what struck me was that he would sit and do it in front of a reporter. That was a sign to me that he was more comfortable in American politics. And he said as much. He said, you know, for years, I didn't think there was anybody for me in conventional politics. And then Trump came along and I realized we have a lot of things in common. We see things the same way. And that for him, I described it as an awakening. That was his term, actually. And I realized something profound was happening, and I had to take stock of it because this was not normal.
This may be a difficult question to answer, but you returned in 2013. Did you see just huge differences in that three-year span of time from 2013 to the election of 2016 as compared to 2016 to now?
It's a really interesting way to frame it. I guess, the difference was that in that period from, it's really 2015 to the election, that was this extraordinary acceleration in the in the movement of American politics, because that's when Trump came on the scene. And he, it's really not overstating this to say that he was like a bolt of lightning to a certain stripe of the American far right, because they had never felt as if they had a candidate from the mainstream Republican Party. And here, not only did they have a candidate, but he was the front runner, and then he was the nominee, and then he won. And so it was this, just this incredible period of validation to them. And I wanted to capture that. The difference then compared to the period that you're describing now, sort of the last few years, is that, you know, this is now, in a way, it's hard to shock us now, because we've all been through that. The last 5 years has been so shocking in some ways. And this is something different. This feels now like the lines are clear among these different tribes in politics. And I say that I say that reluctantly, because I actually think that sometimes we're too quick to associate these different groups. But, you know, that is the reality of how it is. And the process we're in now is about actually trying to stitch things back together again. I don't actually consider it as intractable as it might sound. I actually am of the view, one of the things I describe in the book is that I was really struck by the ways in which you can go to a place like West Virginia, where I used to live, and you know, oftentimes people will sort of just assume it's all Trump country. That's the shorthand term you see in newspapers. I don't really like that term, because that overlooks a huge amount of variety and diversity below the surface. And part of what I wanted to do here was capture that and talk about all of the different ways in which people are actually seeking to define their own political agendas more specifically.
So tell me about the conscious decision of choosing those three places then, of Greenwich, Connecticut, Clarksburg, West Virginia, and of course, Chicago, Illinois.
Well, I've lived in each of them. I grew up in Greenwich, which is a you know, kind of wealthy suburb of New York City, but it's always been an interesting place to get a view into the decision-making at the highest ranks of American capitalism. This goes all the way back to the Industrial Revolution. You could get a window into it. And the big change from 150 years ago, I would say, is that, you know, at the time you had people moving to Greenwich who were these barons of industry. So they were, I mean, these are literal examples. The guy who created the first mass-produced mattress, sort of the Henry Ford of mattresses, lived just up the street. And a guy like that, you know, that was had a very different imprint on the economy than what Greenwich is today, which is it's known as the hedge fund capital of the world. And it is a place in which people are generating great fortune, but it tends to be wealth built on wealth. So you don't own a string of factories so much as you have, you know, financial strategies. That's very, very different in terms of the impact on the economy. Clarksburg, West Virginia, where I worked first job out of college, is a small city in the northern part of the state. And it does give you a feel for coal country and how people have felt politically in what is a majority, predominantly white, predominantly working class area. And I've been in and out of there for years. And I've just been really struck by the way that people have sort of lost a sense of local political identity. There's a very strong sense of cultural identity, but people have lost any sense of kind of a very strong political identity, and they've kind of become much more nationalized in our political conversation. So people associate themselves with these big culture war issues rather than dealing with, well, what is it that my neighbor and I actually have in common? And then the third place is Chicago, which is where my family's from. I worked at the Chicago Tribune for 9 years. And Chicago is, and really has been for a long time, the ideal place to understand the compounding effects of racial segregation in this country. And it's just quite dramatic. If you go to the south side of Chicago, where my family came from, there are neighborhoods there that are more segregated today than they were when Martin Luther King marched in Chicago in 1966. And one of the themes that runs through this whole book is you can't understand how we got so divided without recognizing the degree to which we are segregated to a degree beyond even what we would assume. It's just kind of it's quite dramatic, actually. It sort of infects everything that we think about our politics and our economics.
Evan Osnos is the author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. Let's step back for a moment to Clarksburg, West Virginia, and spending time there and reflecting back, does Joe Manchin make more sense, and does that put him into a context when you spend time there?
Yeah, he does. I've spent a fair amount of time talking to him over the years, trying to understand how his mind works, what he's kind of responding to. And Joe Manchin comes from a little town, Farmington, West Virginia, population of about 300, which is about 45 minutes away from where I used to live. And he grew up in a place that was all Democrats. I mean, the whole town was Democrats for a long time. And it's transformed over the last 20 years to the point that now Farmington, when you look at the vote count, you know, most people voted for Trump. And what that means is that when Joe Manchin thinks about the Republican Party today, unlike a lot of members of the Democratic Party, he doesn't see it and say, I find it kind of impossible to imagine reaching a negotiated solution with these folks across the table. I can't, because, you know, a lot of Democrats would say it's a fool's errand. But Joe Manchin doesn't look at it that way. He's like, these are the people I grew up with. I can persuade him if I just stay at it, if I kind of work at it and try to show that I'm, you know, fighting for them, and maybe I have to give up here and there. But that puts him really at a distinct, differently, at a very different place than where most of his party is. And it drives them nuts, obviously, because he's not a guy who is quite easy to persuade. That being said, though, I will say, Joe, one thing that's really clear is, I guess I would describe him as an improvisational thinker. He will sometimes walk into a room not knowing how he's going to vote and make a choice at that last minute. And that, from Joe Biden's perspective, is very good news, because Biden can kind of lean on him, wrestle him, do the LBJ treatment, and hope that it might actually produce some benefit.
One of the things that struck me, Evan, in the book is that we think, and I guess I entered the book thinking that it was one fury, that was sort of one overall fury. I mean, we all had our grades of it and what caused it. But as you look at these three different places, you look at individual furies and of how it affects these places, and ultimately then how it fits into a larger context of a fury that can grow in an individual and a voting bloc.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're onto something really important, and it's, you know, at the risk of flattering the host here, Joe, you picked up on kind of a key thing, which is, like, you know, the fact is there is not one single fury. There are these multiple streams that are going on in American life. And I think it's the fact that they are all happening at once gives us this impression of kind of generalized disorder. But part of what was so surprising, and in a way actually reassuring to me, was to realize over the course of this research, 6 years of work on Wildland, that these things are not mysterious. They're quite definable. I mean, and they're quite, you can point at them. You can define them on the page. You can measure them statistically, and that means you can begin to fix them. I mean, just to give you one example, our broadcast culture has changed so much over the course of the last 50 years that the average soundbite on television used to be, I think about 40 years ago, the average soundbite was 62 seconds long. Today, the average soundbite is 8 seconds long. Why do I mention that? Why does that contribute to fury? Because it contributes to this kind of, it's both a reflection of, and I think an ingredient in this general shrinking of the attention span that gives us that feeling, that sort of skittery sense of anxiety that so many people have, where we're just kind of hopping from one fact, one mini story to the next, and it's not part of a larger context that gives us any real sense of our connection to one another. That's a hugely important piece of it. It's not one we talk about every day.
And it can be guns, it can be banking regulations, it can be healthcare, it can be an issue that completely takes over a community and a population and becomes a fury.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, sometimes it's not things that people pay any attention to, but they're like this little tiny kernel that begins to sprout over time and produce huge change. I mean, you mentioned banking regulations. One of those fascinating little pivots in history that I describe in Wildland is this moment when the public paid no attention to this, but the rules on Wall Street changed. At the end of the 1960s, basically the banks, which had been private forever, they'd been these private kind of almost clubs where you would, as a banker, you would have a share in the bank, and at the end of your career, you would sell your share to some younger banker who would take over. But the banks wanted to grow, and so they pleaded with the Wall Street, authorities, essentially the stock exchanges, to say, let us become public banks. So they did. And so all of a sudden, one bank after another went public. That brought in huge amounts of cash, but it also changed the incentive. So all of a sudden, the banks were no longer these kinds of fairly risk-averse institutions. They became quite actually risk-tolerant, and then they eventually started to hunt for risk in all kinds of new ways. And you can't understand how the financial crisis happened without that little tiny, it's almost like a railroad switch from when the train went from one track down a different track. And part of this project was about identifying some of those kind of hidden moments in history that explain how we got here.
You write in the book about the 2020 election. Biden won South Carolina by 29 points, and within days, his moderate rivals had exited and endorsed him. On March 3rd, Super Tuesday, he won 10 out of 14 states, effectively securing the nomination. And then almost immediately, the presidential campaign of 2020 became unrecognizable. One week after Super Tuesday, as Americans dawned to the emerging horror of the pandemic, Biden canceled his campaign events and took shelter at home in Delaware, where he would spend the next 8 months of a nearly virtual campaign. As Trump plunged deeper into his rages and fantasies, his unglamorous rival benefited from the contrast. And that leads up to you having an interview with him at his home just, I think, 2 or 3 months before the election. It was a really weird time because nothing about that was conventional.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely, you know, I mean, he was not doing interviews at the time, but I was working on a larger project about him. I'd interviewed him in the past. And so we had some basis to know one another. And so they said, yeah, you can come see him at home, but just, yeah, you got to wear a mask. You got to make sure you're not going to make him, don't get him sick. I had very little interest in infecting the Democratic nominee for president. But also, you know, the interesting thing was that he was so desperate for human contact. They told me in advance, they said, hey, you might also notice he's going to be a little even more sociable than usual. He's a pretty sociable guy. But they said, because he just hasn't seen anybody. And sure enough, when I got there and started interviewing him, I describe it in the book that he was just desperate to kind of talk to anybody who did not work for him, because the only people he could see, they had this very, very tight little window, this little circle of people who were allowed to go near him. So that was a fascinating experience. I mean, as somebody who writes about politics, to be there. But what struck me most, Joe, the thing that really stays with me, is how he felt this crushing sense of responsibility to not screw this up, because from his perspective, this was a period in which the American experiment was really on thin ice. And not only did we have a pandemic that was straining the competence of American institutions, but you also had a president who was already, before the election, beginning to cast doubt on the democratic process. And actually, it turned out to be quite prescient. We didn't know how serious it was going to get.
Evan Osnos is our guest. The name of the book is Wildland, and it is the making of America's Fury. You mentioned that, and I find it fascinating. You know, 2 years or maybe, I don't know, year and a half, 2 years before the election, we were interviewing people on this show, authors of books who had titles like What Happens If He Doesn't Leave? You know, and about the constitutional crisis that would happen if Trump took over and lost and didn't leave. And it wasn't that it was a real surprise, right? I mean, it seemed like it had to have been, even for the Biden team, of thinking, well, this is a very distinct possibility of what could happen here.
Yeah, they were aware of it. And I think, actually, interestingly, they were right about something. Because I remember in the kind of frenzied period before the election and then afterwards, everybody was starting to wonder, well, what if he doesn't leave? What if he really holds on? And they said, people in the Biden campaign and transition were saying to me, we think in the end he will go. I mean, we're just not concerned that he's going to actually hold on. Now, they were right in the strict sense. Yes, he did. He boarded that plane. And remember, he kind of fled town on the morning of the inauguration because he didn't want to be there to actually hand over power in the usual way. But I think it was only really in retrospect that all of us are fully coming to terms with how close it was to actually the collapse of the peaceful transfer of power. You know, that I one of the things I write about in the book is I was struck by how slender the supports were that held up the process. It turned out to come down to these individual actors, people like the Secretary of State of Georgia. I mean, talk about a fragile bulwark against the collapse of democracy, or the, you know, folks in places like Philadelphia who continued counting votes even when there were crowds of protesters outside telling them to stop the steal. So that should be a real alarm bell for all of us to realize that not only does it just, you know, take one president who's casting doubt on democracy to begin to unravel this thing, but actually he didn't come out of nowhere. And what this whole book is about is trying to explain where he did come from so that we might be able to shape the course of the river to prevent it from happening again.
And yet that river is still flowing at a pretty good pace, right? The Trump machine, if you will, is basically running the Republican Party. It is very much in control. It is it's a strong river. And you do wonder at what point, not to torture an analogy here, but you do wonder if it's possible that it's going to go up over its banks or if it's just going to continue to bore into this country and fracture it in half.
Yeah, it's worse today, actually, than it was on January 6th. And, you know, I was a reporter at the Capitol that day covering the insurrection. And I think if you'd told me that 9 months later, things actually would be worse, meaning that large portions of Americans would still believe that Trump won the election, which is what surveys tell us, I wouldn't have believed it. But actually, to be honest now, Joe, you know, sort of what does my own book tell us? My own book tells us that these things don't come from nowhere and they won't disappear as fast. I guess, in a way, I sort of had to be the recipient of my own lessons, which is that he emerged out of a process that took decades. And one of the things I really take seriously is this idea that this, you know, this was building in plain sight, that the prelude to Trump, the preamble, all of the prehistory, there's no mystery about where they came from. You can see it told in a story of politics and economics and the way that we began to allow people who were starting to create the active ingredients of Trumpism, that was happening for years. But honestly, I don't think we fully grasped how catastrophic it could be until the moment in which it was so gravely clear.
So you said just a moment ago that it's worse now than it was then on January 6th. And I take that to mean that fury is worse. The fury that was there that you looked at, that the making of that fury is very much with us. And and we see and we wonder just how furious it can get.
Yeah, I mean, I have a chapter in the book that is worrisome, but, you know, needed to be kind of written, which is about what are these patterns in American history about the intersection between violence and democracy. What do they tell us? And one of the things they tell us is that when people begin to talk about politics in very violent terms, the kinds of ways that you heard it described on January 6th, the idea of, you know, this being a life or death struggle. And, you know, remember there was somebody set up a a hangman's noose outside the Capitol. That kind of political theater actually has deeper meaning and deeper worrying effect. And we do need to worry about the possibility of more violence in our politics. That's not alarmism. That's just the reality. And at the same time, I think that there's something very healthy about the fact that we're now talking about it and saying, look, this is not something that's just the irrelevant fringe over there. This is actually infecting a big part of our politics. And we have to talk about it. There are members of Congress who are sort of tacitly or not so tacitly condoning the use of force in politics. And that simply cannot be allowed to continue. We have to have some standards. And I'm not going to pretend this is both sides are part of the problem. The Republican Party today has failed to police itself. So you have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who in any other period in the last 50 years would have been an irrelevant figure, but somehow she's managed to create her own following. And that is and you don't have a Republican leadership that's strong enough to resist. And as long as that's the case, we're in a fragile state of affairs.
The name of the new book is The Making of America's Fury. That's the subtitle. Wildland is the name of the book. It is published by FSG. Evan Osnos, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Wildland. It is The Making of America's Fury by Evan Osnos, published by FSG. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.